The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is the Agile Uprising Podcast.
Started. Jeff Sutherland, who's a good friend of mine, is also in the Boston area, and we both were looking at the state of the art for building software because we're trying to build software for use by other people. And we're talking, and we both had come up with a very similar approach. And Jeff had come up with his approach based on lean thinking. He really admired Naka and Takahashi. And so he had adopted a lot of their ideas, and I really liked some ideas that I got from DuPont, their advanced research facility, which were based on advanced process control, complex process control. And when I went down and talked to them, they said, well, yeah, you know, software development is very complex, and the way you're building it now, how's it going? And I said, well, you know, geez, one, only 16% of projects do what they're supposed to, and the rest are in some ways considered waste. People do not like their jobs. They come to work and they moan and groan at that. The canary in the coal mine women are fleeing our industry as fast as they can, finding any other job they can possibly have. Things are not going well. And he said, well, you're using the wrong approach. So Jeff and I spent 4 or 5 years coming up with and researching an approach toward building software that would be more flexible, give people more control, and allow the creative process not only to bloom and to flow, but to do so in a way there where you could control the risk and maximize the value. Because software is not, certainly you do it for fun, but it's nice if you can support your family and make an industry out of it. So we spent about 5 years working on this and came up with our approach, and we presented a paper at a conference in 1995. And that was the first time we went public. And much to our surprise, a lot of other people were taken by the approach. And we not only found out were they taken by the approach, but they were trying stuff like it. Now, if you worked in a big company like General Electric or State Farm or Liberty Mutual or that, you had to build software the old-fashioned way, where you said, where you reviewed your challenge to develop all the requirements that the user told you by a certain date for a certain cost. And it was horrible. People underneath the out of sight who were having to do this to make a living for themselves, like Jeff and myself, were doing it very differently. And from 1995 to 2001, we all started talking back and forth. We ran experiments. I ran an experiment at Fidelity. Back in 1998, if you wanted to manage your Fidelity account like you could with Charles Schwab or E-Trade, you had to either call them or you could go downtown Boston and use a 3270 green screen type thing. And they were losing business. And they couldn't get it up on the internet. Their process was so moribund. So they said, okay, we will hold everyone off and do something. And we did. Within 30 days, we had their first version of their website up, and they built it, and it was like a team of two teams of 18 people. And it happens over and over again. When you have, I was working with what is now GE Medical at the same time, Jeff was also. And if you have an x-ray or an MRI, those things taken of you, you used to have film. You know, they'd put it against this transparent thing. If you went to another doctor in another state, they'd have to redo the same thing. And that was kind of crazy. And so what they came up with was the idea of teleradiology. That is, why don't we take that image and put it on a hard drive so different people can collaborate about it, talk about it, radiologists can work on it, make suggestions and comments, and it's available as part of this. This is like the start of the electronic medical record. And for 2 years, you know, we just sat there struggling because the internet didn't have the capacity. Now, if we had had one of the standard projects, that we'd have been fired and thrown out. Instead, we were making little bits of progress and little bits of progress. And finally, we got enough bandwidth capacity, and we went live. GE was the first with it. So these were creative experiments. You know, there was no certainty, there was no surety, and there was a lot of risk. So this was a way of our approach allowed you to maximize your risk to 1 month's worth of salaries for a bunch of developers. And at the end of the month, you would see what they could do. And so I would talk to them and say, so Fidelity really needs some website that can access down into their data so we can get customer records. And they'd say, yeah, well, that's going to be tough. I said, so in a month, what can you do? They said, well, and we'd talk about it for a day. And then I'd say, okay, so we have like a month to do our best to do this. If you need anything at all, because this is probably the most important thing in Fidelity, let me know. And at the end of the month, we'd see what they had done. And then we would say, okay, that's a really good thing. And the rest of Fidelity gathered around and said, but that's not according to the standards. And the business people said, get out of here. And he said, instead, what can you do in the next sprint? They said, well, what's the most important thing that we can add to make this website viable and your customer friendly? He said, how about these things? And so suddenly we started seeing software. So Motorola built the clamshell phone. Everyone had the clamshell. Even I had the clamshell phone, or one after the other as I lost them. And suddenly there's the iPhone. Not good. And so out in Schaumburg, Illinois, the people who built the telephone operating system and the telephone wanted to talk to me about, you know, how to do this. And I said, well, you know, what we could do is we could sit there and list the major features that are in the iPhone that you don't have and see how long it would take to develop something like that. He said, well, we really don't have to do that because we haven't been sitting here. Across the last number of years, we've been just building stuff like that, and we have it all up on the shelf, and, you know, it's all there. And I'm like, well, you know, why don't we just, you know, if you want to use Scrum, why don't we take just one sprint and see how much of it we can pull together that would impress your management to say, hey, let's proceed. And they said, well, we can't do that. They said, our management wouldn't let us. It's not the way we do things here. And they said, and also, the stuff that we put up there, it really isn't ready for prime time. You know, it's kind of crappy. Some of it works, it doesn't work together. You know, it's just, you know, work in progress that we did. So bear with me. I'm at Motorola, famous Razr phone. How'd you get that built? Oh, that. It was a famous thing with Motorola. It was about 16 people that worked together for a year and a half and came up with it. And this was all under the radar. No one knew about it. And they came up with the first version of the Razr. And then it was taken by corporate and became what it is. And I said, so what happened to those guys? They said, well, they go through Motorola and give speeches. You know, they tell people what they did. I said, so no one said, is there any value in us imitating what they did? They said, well, no, we're a very big, we're a defense contractor, government work. You know, we have to have a proven process going back to, it's not creative work, it's a process that anyone can follow. And I've seen that so often. You know, the opportunities and people trapped in the way of the corporate culture and not willing to risk doing something differently because it's a different culture. So, you know, let's say we don't tell anyone. Can you guys work with me for like 2 months? And we can start by coming up with, you know, what was possible, and we can spend 2 months coming up with something. And do you have like someone from the business side, the product side, we can drag in who will, you know, do this? And so we do it for a couple of months just on the side. You can always get away with 2 months. And then the guy from product or the business side with the early ATM stuff would have something. They'd say, and they go to some board meeting, they'd say, look what I have. I was like, really? That's incredible. And so it started taking off. And it was, you can't talk about a different culture. You have to have people see results that create value for them. We were experimenting, and I think it was Jim Highsmith. He said, why don't we get together, because I think we've pulled together enough information to make a statement. And so we got together, not in Ohio, not in Indiana, not in Oklahoma. We got together in Snowbird. You know, ski season, a lot of them were skiers. And we started talking about the things that we had done that were common, the things we found worked, the things we found that didn't work. And we said, well, we're not going to tell people what to do. The idea of this is you're doing creative work. What you need are guidelines and values and things that can help you, not constrain you. So we said, why don't we come up with a bunch of principles, and also let's come up with some value statements, but let's not say them as you should, this is important. Instead, let's say, if you're in a real life situation, you may have these alternatives. We would recommend that you do this instead of this, because this may lead you into blind alleys, whereas this may be more open. And we published this. We called it the Agile Manifesto. Whoever came up with that name, brilliant and great name. And Ward Cunningham. We're all back together again, and we're saying, what are we gonna do? These people are calling up and they're saying, I want to join. And I did something I learned in the service I should have never done. I said, why don't we just start something called the Agile Alliance, and we'll let people join it. And then we'll hold conferences where they can get together and share ideas. And I think, so I started it. I think William and Mary Poppendick helped me a whole lot. And Alistair Coburn tried to get pulled together the first conference again in Salt Lake City. And the people suddenly had a way of sharing ideas, and suddenly we're seeing wikis pop up, we're seeing conversation groups, we're seeing other conferences, user groups. I mean, it was like going into a prison, opening the gates and saying, go forth and do what you think is the right thing to do. And I was biking down Lexington bike path, and a guy comes up next to me and he said, say, hey, what do you do? I said, oh, I build software. He said, yeah, you know, I work in software too. He said, you ever heard of Scrum? And I'm like, this is spreading. And it is. Now you have like, at last count, some 12, 13 million people in the world building software with Scrum. And that's just a countable number. You go into Berlin and it's in the coffee houses. They talk, they share. They had something called the Spitfire Pub XP Tuesday group in London. I mean, this is everywhere. All the products that you've seen rolling out since 2000 have been done using an Agile approach. So in 2009, I formed Scrum.org, which is now my home, and certainly the home of very, very solid information on what Scrum is and how to scale it, standards for it, courseware for it. People worldwide take assessments, standardized assessments, on how well they know how to build software using Scrum. And if they get very, very high scores, they can get certification. So it's a source of people talking and working and validating and websites and that. It would be arrogant beyond belief for me to accept this as my achievement. I'm certainly a spokesman, I'm an instigator, I'm someone who causes some turmoil and things to happen. And I've been in the middle of this change that's happened. But without all the people who have been doing this and suffering and taking credit and making this happen worldwide, this is a worldwide thing, and it is the way software is built now. And without all of them doing this and making this effort, I'm irrelevant. You know, I'm a source and I'm a person who makes things, but it's not me. It's kind of like coming up with something that people like that makes sense to them, and everyone says, wow. And after that, you know, basically all you're doing is saying, yeah, maybe this way, maybe that way, you know, this is how you could do it, and keeping them on track. But this isn't me.